See, I could have selected to set this up. Let's see. All right, everyone can see that okay? So that was a great talk by Molly, and she covered a lot of different areas at a very, very high level. I always get inspired whenever I see Molly speak, because she talks with such great enthusiasm and optimism, and it's almost like, my goodness, we can actually do all this. So I'm going to take you a little bit deeper. In fact, a lot deeper. I'm going to take you down from the 10,000-foot level to like the 1-foot level. I'm going to talk about some of the trends that we've been seeing with semantic markup, with using XHTML in more and more meaningful ways, and we're going to talk about some of the more interesting challenges that we're encountering. But the first thing I want to do is let everyone know that the entire hypertext and the podcast, this presentation, is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution 2.0 license. And I, too, am a fan of Flickr, so first thing, I'm going to take a couple pictures of all you guys. Turnabout's fair play. Wow, there's a lot of people here. These also, when I get around to posting them, will be Creative Commons licensed. All right. So, what do we mean by XHTML? XHTML is one of these buzzwords that's thrown about a lot. W3C has a very precise definition. It's extensible hypertext markup language. Now, when I talk about XHTML, I'm talking about it more in the context of today's web. And for a lot of people, that means very different things. So, the reason it's in quotes is, when I say XHTML, I'm really talking about modern use of HTML4 and compatible XHTML 1.0. So that's using the XHTML standard, complying with Appendix C, which those of you who are familiar with it, writing XHTML that can actually be read by older browsers that don't have complete XHTML support, that only support HTML. And finally, it means it's valid. So meaningful. What do you mean by meaningful? Well, let me ask just a couple of quick questions here. How many of you out there write XHTML or HTML of any sort for a living? That's quite a few people. How many of you out there have been writing HTML for more than about 5 years? Still quite a bit. So you'll know what I mean when I talk about HTML, that you want it to be strict rather than transitional. When I talk about meaningful, that's what I mean. Like, that's the subset that you're using. It means that you're not using any tables for layout. So I asked this question about 6 months ago in South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. And I wonder, I'm going to ask here, how many of you that are writing HTML out there are using tables for layout for whatever reason? Come on, admit it. All right, so a few folks are still doing it, which is about the same number that I saw in Austin. But what's amazing is if I would have asked that question 5 years ago, how many of you were using tables for layout? Okay, right. So these are some things that have dramatically changed over the past 5 years, and I'm going to take you through some of the next steps. So even though we have strict XHTML, there's a bunch of elements that are left there that are still, for the most part, almost completely presentational. So if you can avoid, you know, bold and break and italic and sub, super and sub, you should avoid them completely. These effectively have been replaced with style sheets. So the other aspect of using meaningful XHTML is using elements for their meaning, not their presentation. So for example, H1 doesn't mean big and bold, nor does the EM tag mean make it italic. I mean, just because you're using M's, you can still abuse them. And of course, block quote doesn't mean indent this. So these are very common practices that developed in the early days of the web that folks have figured out, like, this is not, you don't need to do this anymore because you have style sheets to achieve all your effects. But for more on the topic of what is not meaningful XHTML, take a look at the following articles. And these are all hyperlinked from the presentation. This will all be online afterwards. from some of these names you've probably heard of before, Doug Bowman and Molly Holschlag. Now, I want to talk about taking things to the next level. Everyone here, I would bet, knows how to use a paragraph tag and knows how to use a header tag, an H1, H2, H3, H4, etc. Now, using HTML in a semantic way is both something that's very new to the community as a whole, but it's actually very old as well, because HTML was originally developed to capture meaning in documents. Now, when I talk about capturing meaning and using HTML for this, I like to use the analogy of Goldilocks. How many people know the story of Goldilocks? Okay, good. So you want to use elements that are not too semantic for the purpose you're using, and not lacking of semantics for the purpose you're using. So you want to use the element that's just the right level of semantic use for what you're using. So for example, if you're talking about a term that you're defining, you're using a definition element. But if you're just talking about something where you're emphasizing it, or you're talking about a term, but it's not the definition of the term, then you probably don't want to use that definition element. It's a bit subtle, and as you write more and more semantic markup, it becomes really clear what's what. And finally, you should consider div and span as a last resort. So I know that with a lot of layouts, we have to put a lot of classes in, a lot of divs and spans in to get lots of different effects due to various CSS incompatibilities, et cetera, et cetera. That's all fine and good, and you have to do, at the end of the day, you have to make it look the way the client wants you to make it look. But when you start out, your goal should be to keep it as semantic as possible, which means try and minimize your use of your divs and spans. All right, I'm going to go through a few really simple examples of semantic XHTML that go above and beyond what people are normally used to using. So the first element that I want to talk about is the address element. How many of you have actually written a web page with the address element? Okay, some of you, maybe about a quarter. How many of you have actually read the HTML4 spec where it talks about what the address element means? Okay, about maybe half that. All right, this is perhaps the worst named element in all of HTML, because it doesn't mean what it says. It actually does not, it's not there for marking up literal addresses, which, you get people with the best of intentions saying, all right, I'm going to write semantic markup. Oh, look, there's an address tag. Great. I'll mark up all my addresses with address. That's not what it's for. It's literally just for mark up the contact information on a page for a document. And so if this is one thing you learn about HTML today, just take this one home, because this is actually quite common. How many web pages do you know that actually have something, a piece of information there about how to contact the webmaster or the company? Probably most of them. And the other part that's left in the spec that's a little bit sort of ambiguous, but has a potential, is that you can use address to denote information about part of a document, not just the whole document. So here's a simple example. You might see on a web page today somebody saying, please contact the webmaster, etc. Well, by simply putting an address around that, you've all of a sudden made that contact information much more semantic. All right, the next example I want to talk to you about is something we've seen more and more of. So Molly talked a lot about blogs, and one of the things that blogs do a lot is they quote each other. One example that I do is I quote from Eric's blog all the time, because he says these amazing things, these amazingly profound things. And the key elements for doing quotes from a blog is the cite and block quote elements. And you'd be surprised how many people just simply copy and paste the text and don't even quote things. But if you want to make things more semantic, you want to actually add in your block quote tags around the portion of the text that you're quoting and your cite tag around the citation of who it is you're quoting. But not only that, you want to also add the URL that you're citing to your block quote tag. Another example I want to talk to you about is corrections and updates. When we're all blogging in instant real time, something happens and you blog it in immediately, you're like, okay, I want to be the first one to blog it out there. We oftentimes make mistakes, and that's okay, because the advantage is you can go back and say, okay, let's go ahead and update that. This is exactly where you use the ints and del elements. So you might have an example where you have some blog posts. You say, okay, I've talked about some information. Oh, here's an update I'm going to add. It's actually quite trivial to go ahead and add the tags to remove what used to be there and put in something new. Now, this is important, because if a reader reads something on your blog And they say, okay, I've read that. That's interesting. And they come back later, and it looks like your blog post has completely changed. None of what used to be there is there. There's kind of this sense of discontinuity. And one of the things that blogs have really sort of brought to the forefront is a sense of accountability, a sense of when I post something, I'm saying that here's a permalink. You can link to this. And not everyone does this, but it's more and more part of the culture. So if you use Incendel to do it that way, then all of a sudden you can achieve some good effects. Like, for example, striking out the various parts that are deleted and underlining the parts that are inserted. All right. Now, I want to talk about tables for a little bit. I know I said no layout tables, right? What we're seeing more and more, though, as people move away from using tables for layout, is all of a sudden when you start to see actual tables in real markup, they have real meaning. And in fact, not only do the cells have meaning, but the headers have meaning as well. So this is an example I've taken from actually the Web Essentials 05 site itself. And here we have the headers telling you what rooms that some of the sessions are in, and the times of the rooms as well. If you actually peel this back and look at the markup, you see a bunch of table rows and a bunch of table headers. And I'm going to talk to you about two new attributes, axis and headers. Actually, they're not very new. How many of you have used the axis and headers attributes? That's impressive. I'm very impressed. This is a very advanced crowd. These attributes are sort of deep in the depths of HTML4. They've been there for quite some time, 1998. And they're not very well understood, and they're not very well used. They're oftentimes used in the accessibility community, but I want to give you some good reasons for using them even above and beyond that. But actually, I want to show you how to do it first. So taking that table, you literally take all the headers that are actually giving you information, such as the location or the time, and you mark them up with, well, what is the axis of information that those headers are giving to you? Is it the location or the time? And literally using that human readable word, which some accessibility user agents will actually read out as part of a table cell. The other piece you have to do is attach an ID to each of those table cells, those table header cells. Because the next thing you do is you add the headers attribute, which goes ahead and for each cell lists the set of IDs of the table headers that apply to it. Now, this is really important because now when you have a reader program or you have an XML parser program that's looking at a particular table cell, it can tell you exactly what are the headers that apply to that cell without having to do a complete table layout. Do people know what I mean by a complete table layout? Let me talk a little bit about that. If you look at all the different browsers that are out there, if you look at what they have to do to support things like row span and call span and tables nested within tables three levels deep, because, well, web designers love to do that. It's an incredible amount of code. And it's the kind of code that you don't want to have to require accessibility tools, screen readers, or any other new tools, some of these XML parsers, some of these new types of applications that are coming up, to have to use. So by indicating explicitly what the headers are for a cell, you provide this information in a semantic form that other applications can use. And with a few style rules, it becomes actually really obvious what you can do by applying styles directly to a specific column or row, not by the presentational what row number or column number it is, but by instead what is the axis that you want to highlight. So in this example, we've highlighted the 1:30 p.m. talks, and we've also highlighted the McFarlane rooms at the same time, and the intersection thereof, all done semantically, not by what position they are on the table. So a quick summary. Axis and headers, they make your tables more semantic. Your semantic tables are more semantic. They enable styling of rows and columns semantically rather than by index. They help accessibility as well. And I'm not going to go too much into that because we have a few other talks on accessibility. There's a couple of references you can check out. The HTML techniques, the WCAG, tells you exactly how to do that. And believe it or not, there are actually screen readers that support these attributes now, which is really good. It's one of the things that Joe Clark wrote about in a recent List Apart article. And finally, by doing this, you actually enable additional applications. And I'm not going to talk about those today. We'll talk about a little bit of some of those tomorrow. All right. So assuming you've mastered all the elements of XHTML, the raw elements, you've looked at all the strict elements, said, okay, I know what each one of these does, I know what each one of them means, and I know exactly when to use it and when not to use it. You run out. You're like, well, this is a very limited set of building blocks to use. What do I do now? Well, one option is to go ahead and start inventing your own elements. And that was sort of the path that was laid out with XML. But, you know, for a lot of reasons I won't go into, there really hasn't been a lot of adoption along that route as far as mixing new elements into HTML in that fashion. So instead, why not take a look at this in a different way and say, well, by mixing and matching some of these building blocks that we have, as if they were Lego bricks, literally, we can build completely new semantics out of them. And if you think about the 40 or so elements, visible semantic elements in HTML, how many possible combinations are there? There's a huge number of combinations. And I think that one of the things that we're just now starting to understand is that by mixing and matching some of these combinations, we can indicate very specific semantics, which we hadn't really thought about before. But one of the challenges is when you invent a new way of doing things like this, you really have to come up with a name for it. And so the name that I've proposed, well, and people have been asking for it too, the name that I proposed goes back to an analogy from chemistry, that of elements and compounds. Because literally, when you have elements, right, they have a certain behavior. When you mix the elements and you actually have compounds, they have behaviors that are unique from the elements themselves. So here's a working definition for you. An XHTML compound is two or more elements used in combination to express a new meaning that neither one of the elements did by themselves. So I'm going to give you a few examples of XHTML compounds. The first example is a block of code. So I know I've seen lots and lots of websites where you say, here's a block of code example to share, whether it's PHP or CSS or JavaScript. And wouldn't it be great if you could actually index and discover all these different blocks of code? So when you think about what is a block of code, it's got two really important aspects to it. One is that the white space actually matters, which indicates you really should be using the pre-element. Now, this is kind of interesting, because when I brought this up before with people, they say, well, pre-element, isn't that presentational? I mean, pre, right? Pre-formatted text. And I say, well, almost. It's almost complete presentation, but not quite. It actually indicates a very important semantic, which is that it indicates to the browser, in fact, to anything that's consuming your web pages, that the white space within those tags actually has meaning. As opposed to normally, within any other tag, the semantic is that the white space can be collapsed and doesn't have any meaning short of that. And the other aspect of a block of code is that it's code. So we have an element for that. It's the code element. So here's a really simple, quick example demonstrating how you might take an existing way of writing up a code example and simply add a pre-code block around it to mark it up as a block of code. This is what I mean by an XHTML compound. It can be that simple. By joining the pre and code in this nested relationship like this, you're basically inventing this new semantic. This is one of my favorite examples. How many of you are familiar with the whole Abbott and Costello skit? Who's on first, right? Very nice and simple short. I like their skits because they don't really say too much and it's easy to mark up in a slide. So one of the ways that you've probably seen conversations marked up on the web by folks that are fairly experienced is using a definition list and saying, well, DT for the person speaking and DD for what they're saying. It's very common. In fact, it's listed as an example in the HTML4 spec, so it must be right, right? Well, I'm going to tell you no, it's not. This is a complete abuse of what the definition list and the definition term and definition definitions mean. If you actually read the spec, read the normative parts of the spec, and defines what these elements mean to you. And then you look at this example, you're like, there's a complete disconnect here. They said it's A, and then they're using it for B. Well, I don't have a really good explanation for that, except perhaps habit, or perhaps the spec changed and the examples didn't. I'm going to call it out as abuse. I'm going to say, don't do that. Conversations are not about definitions. Conversations are about speakers and quotes. They're about people, and what are they saying? So let's try this again. There are elements in XHTML to represent speakers and to represent quotes. The first one is a cite. So when you cite something, it can be a book, it can be a URL, it can also be a person saying something. And the other one is a block quote. So these are both really well understood elements. You mix them together, And what's the other aspect of a conversation? A conversation typically has a temporal ordering to it. So if you say things out of order in a conversation, it usually doesn't make that much sense. So that's the other aspect of a conversation, is it's an ordered list of speakers saying things. And that's exactly what we've got here. We've combined OL, LI, cite, and block quote to come up with this completely new semantic, conversation. There's no conversation tag in HTML. We just made it up. So finally, I want to go over an example of a bibliography. Now, this is one that's fairly common on the web. And so you'd think, well, this has been figured out, right? Not really. Not in HTML. And in fact, I was just looking at a few W3C documents this morning myself, like saying, well, what kind of markup are they using for their bibliographies? And surprisingly, it actually wasn't that semantic. So I wonder, well, what is a bibliography? Anyone want to hazard a guess? It's a list. It's an alphabetically ordered list at that. So what does that tell us? Well, let's use OL and LI, right? It's a list of citations. Okay, well, HTML has an element for that as well, so use a cite. Now, this is one of those things where once you come up with the answers, it's like, wow, this is so obvious. Why isn't everyone doing this? So let's see if we can mark this up and see what happens. So here's a few citations, bibliography. Mark it up with a cite. That works just fine. Go ahead and add a list around it, and we'll talk about that class in a moment. And let's see if we can style this to actually look like a bibliography. So here you go. I think just a couple of style rules, and taking what was very few elements, and style it to look like a bibliography. It's very simple, doesn't take that much work. And again, part of the point here is to be able to marry the beauty of, or rather, the significance of having capturing the meaning with the beauty of CSS and coming up with actually the proper presentation as well, because both are important. Now, this example illustrates some of the limitations that you run into with XHTML compounds and elements overall. The first is that I needed a class name to style this example distinctly from any other example. There's no way in CSS, not yet anyway, to say, well, for this list item, for list items that have a cite inside of them, style the list item in a different way. You can style the cite in a different way if it has a list item as a parent, but you can't style the list item differently if it has a cite as a child. So because of that, we had no choice but to add a class and style based on the class instead of based on the context, which is too bad. But it's a limitation. The other limitation that's pretty obvious from that example is that citations have much more structure than just a single element. They've got the title, they've got the authors, they've got the date of publications, sometimes they have URLs, they've got publication houses, all this kind of information is fully well structured. And XHTML lacks the elements to capture these semantics. Now, there's been a lot of folks that are into citations. There's been a whole effort called Dublin Core. How many of you are familiar with Dublin Core? Right. So you understand that a lot of people have applied a lot of work at solving this problem, but is there a good way to actually take that information that's visible and mark it up with Dublin Core elements in your HTML? Not really. So this takes us to the next step. When you've run out of semantic XHTML elements to use, and you've looked at using XHTML compounds and use them as much as you can, and then you run out of those. So you say, well, you still need to apply more meanings that I can't capture through the combination of elements that I have. I need new elements. Right? I need to go to that super collider and build some new elements, which I think can mix and match with existing elements and cause new effects. So for that, you have nothing left but really to use the class names to indicate your semantics. So let's talk a little about meaningful class names. Class names really became well known once CSS reached a level of adoption, or rather support among the browsers, that you could all of a sudden style any element to look like anything. Right? You could style an H1 heading to look like a superscript. I don't know why you would, but you certainly could. The classes gave you so much power that you could redefine the language completely, and you could do so presentationally, you could do so meaningfully, you could do anything with it. So a lot of web developers did. How many of you have substituted a div class equals clear for a BR That's right. A lot of folks have. I've seen it too. And or something like a how about paragraph, class equals blue. These are very common uses. To say, well, I just want to make it blue, but I don't want to put a font tag in there to change the color. So I'll just say class equals blue and I'll define it somewhere else. But what happens when you want to change your theme of your site? And now you've got all these classes called blue. You want to change to green. So you have style rules that say things like dot blue, brace, color green. How much sense does that make? One of the sort of informal contests that Eric and I have going, Eric Meyer here, is that how many different products can we find where they have actually made this mistake with their brand name? So literally, things like Simple Green, the lemon version. And I think there are a few others like that too. But it just sort of points out that this is not a new problem. Others have already made this mistake. So what should we use classes for? You should use classes to literally take the existing elements that you have and indicate details about them. So if you've got a special type of paragraph, indicate it with a class. If you have a special type of site, indicate it with a class. Perhaps you take that code example that I showed you, that pre-code, that block of code example, and because you know it's CSS, you can say code, class equals CSS, to indicate that it's a CSS code example. Now, one of the other effects that we saw with huge adoption of CSS was classes everywhere, on everything, because you can. And this is really unnecessary, because one of the things you can do with CSS is indicate not just the element that you want to style directly, but you can say, well, I only want to style this element when it's inside this other element. And by using that notion of context, you can actually achieve the vast majority of effects that people try to do with multiple classes on all the different elements. I want to just touch on really briefly the case sensitivity issue. How many are familiar with what I'm talking about as far as case-sensitive classes? Yeah, you've all been bitten by this problem, haven't you? There are certain browsers, I'm not going to name names, that treat classes case-insensitively. So they'll treat something as like all capitals, emphasis, or all capitals CSS, or lowercase CSS, as the same class name. There are other browsers that comply with the HTML4 spec and treat the class names as case-sensitive. So to avoid this problem, the recommendation is stick to using all lowercase classes and avoid the very common practice among programmers, which is to literally camel case adjoined words. Now, I'm not sure even how this practice came about, but it's one of these odd things that as a programmer you do and you don't even think about it, but it's actually not very readable to your average person. What's much more readable is to simply separate the words, if you want to, with a dash. So we talked a little about semantic classes and presentational classes. And I don't want to talk too much more about this, but there's been a bunch of essays written on the subject that you can go check out offline or online later. So where to go for more meaningful XHTML? The first thing you want to do is go through and understand the visible semantic elements that are in XHTML itself. Right? Those are the building blocks you're starting with. Once you feel like you've got a good grasp of those, learn from existing examples of XHTML compounds. Now, one of the amazing things that's happened in the last 5 years with this social web that Molly's telling us about is that we're using the tools themselves to teach each other about them. So when Eric develops a technique, he blogs it. When Doug develops a technique, he blogs it. And we may notice each other's techniques and go, oh, wow, that's a really great technique. And I've got an idea that maybe here's an alternative or here's an improvement. And we'll blog back and forth, and all this expertise is generated on the web and archived and searchable and indexable. So literally, just by going out there and looking for what people are talking about, you can learn a lot. Go ahead and experiment. You've got an idea, pick two random elements, mash them together, and try to figure out what could that possibly mean. See if it's got some utility. Because once in a while, you'll find something that makes sense, and you'll be able to use. Discuss with your peers. So like I said, you can go invent your own stuff and blog it, but even more important than that, talk to your peers about it. You are your own, this whole community that we've got is your biggest resource. Never before have we been able to be interconnected as we are today. Now, that's of course got some of those downsides as well, but use the positive sides of it. Learn from others' meaningful class names. So how did we all learn to code HTML? How many of you sat down and read like a 200-page book to learn how to use HTML? How many of you chose view source in the browser and started copying and pasting? Yes. So that still applies. View source is absolutely alive and kicking. So look at some of the markup of some of the really beautiful designs that you've seen, the Valo designs you've seen, and you know the experts that you know to come to trust. And look at what they're doing with their class names. And say, well, maybe they're using really interesting sets of class names that make sense. Maybe I can reuse their work rather than trying to figure it out on my own. And finally, I want to say, to learn about more meaningful XHTML examples, we'll see you at the next talk I'm going to give tomorrow, which is microformats, evolving the web. So thank you very much. I'd like to give you some questions and answers. All right. So I believe there are some microphones on the floor.
Who's got the first question? I need a hand.
Yeah, I was just wondering what the browser support was like for the styling of axes and headers of tables. Some of the examples you showed.
Right. So the examples I showed for styling the axes and headers of tables. There we go. What I'm using here is a couple of things. We're using the IE selectors, we're using element selectors, and we're using attribute selectors. So the attribute selectors here are the most challenging ones. All right.